Rebecca Weiss, thank you for joining me today on Other Plans at Katie and Kay. I'm really looking forward to your interview.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure to talk about birds with you.
You wrote an article about your big year of birding with Mark Fuller for the Aspen Sojourner last July. I'd like to start by having you read an excerpt from there.
Okay, great. These are the first two paragraphs from that article. 22 people stand silently at the edge of a dirt road near basalt, their binoculars trained on a steep hillside covered in a dense tangle of scrub oak and vines. Like a sportscaster, I work to call the locations and movements of four orange and yellow birds that are flitting in and out of view among the foliage. The flame-colored plumage of these western tanagers is lit by the morning sun, and as the birders glimpse them through binoculars, hushed comments issue forth. An unfeigned, wow, stunning, to my right, a whispered, hermosa, to my left. The only other sounds are the gentle rustle of the grass beneath our feet and the faint sounds of camera lenses and shutters.
Wow, that just there gets me really excited about waking up early to go birding. So thank you for that.
So much fun, and it's wonderful to see people so captured and so focused when we have moments like those.
You also authored the book Birds of Aspen and the Roaring Fork Valley with Mark Fuller. On the back, under your short bio, we see that you were introduced to the appreciation of birds by your father. What was it about birds that drew the attention of your father?
He grew up in rural Minnesota and was just naturally outside all the time. And he was sort of like a naturalist of sorts, an expert on the creatures and the plants and everything around where he lived. And birds are pretty watchable. Like, as far as wildlife goes, birds are the most watchable form of wildlife. And so I think naturally he keyed into looking for them, noticing them, and trying to figure out what they were when he found interesting birds. So that was his approach, and it sort of caught fire with me, too. I love to notice animals of all kinds whenever we were out and about. And then my dad got into building bird houses and bird feeders, and he's built literally thousands of bird houses and probably hundreds of bird feeders in his life. So all of that kind of rubbed off on me, and I got interested in biology, all living things, and I've had several areas that I've delved into more deeply, and birds just is my main one right now.
What are some early memories that you have of birds and birding?
Oh, wow. I remember one funny moment when my dad and I were out checking nest boxes. And so during nesting season, he would go and regularly check on the bluebird nest boxes that he put up in order to just check out which species were actually nesting in them and how many eggs did they lay and what was their success with fledging their young. And I remember one time he was checking out a nest box that had a family of chickadees in it, and one of the adult chickadees landed right on his head. And as a little girl looking up at my really tall dad with this tiny little bird perched on his head for a brief moment, it was hysterical and precious at the same time. So that one's burned in my memory as a fond moment.
And then you started at ACES back in 1993, I believe. How did you hear about ACES?
I heard about ACES from a friend in college. It was their internship that drew me to ACES. This was the summer after I graduated with my bachelor's in biology. And prior to that, I spent all my summers during undergrad alternating between doing field research and more educational programs, environmental education and outdoor education. And I kind of veered toward education because I really enjoyed the people interaction. And that's how I zeroed in on ACES and their Summer Naturalist internship.
Did you have a chance to hold the Golden Eagle Belle before she passed away?
I did, and that was just such a magical experience. To hold a 13-pound Golden Eagle on your gloved hand is quite an experience. This is a powerful bird whose feet have the crushing power of a German Shepherd's jaws. And if she really wanted to, she could do some damage through the thick leather glove that we used to handle her. But fortunately, the original Golden Eagle down at ACES was basically a cream puff on the inside. And she had a very special demeanor that made her just perfect for her role at ACES as an educator bird, allowing so many different people to train to handle her. Normally, Golden Eagles are difficult to handle and will only tolerate being handled by just, you know, one or two or three people. But this eagle was very amenable and open to lots of folks handling her. So, you know, normally in the wild, we wouldn't get anywhere that close to a Golden Eagle. So it was amazing that people of all ages could have such a close encounter with her and be impressed with her special attributes, her talons, her beak, and her piercing eyes. And, you know, to lock eyes with a Golden Eagle is quite an incredible experience. You can just feel the energy and realize, wow, this is a top-tier predator, a pretty fierce animal, and she's well-equipped for her lifestyle and what she does. And she did her job really well, but it was wonderful. I'm so grateful I had a chance to get to know that bird.
Before you came back to ACES, you worked a few different places. You worked at the Rocky Mountain Biological Lab in Gothic. Tell us about banding the hummingbird. That must have been really tricky.
Yes, definitely. Handling hummingbirds is very delicate process, and their heart rates are so high that we have to be very careful handling them in particular, because the stress levels can have an impact on them. So we try to do it as quickly as possible. And actually, my role was helping with banding all sorts of songbirds there. The hummingbirds were definitely a special category. So I removed hummingbirds from mist nets, and I put them in the little cloth stuff sacks that we would kind of hold them in quietly while they were waiting to be processed at the banding station. And that was basically all I had to do hands-on with the hummingbirds.
What songbirds were you working with?
The songbirds that we caught in the mist nets at Gothic were typical of the kind of high montane, lower subalpine life zone that the lab is situated in, with open meadows, riparian willows, aspen forest, and the nearby conifers. So we were catching a variety of things. Probably our most common bird to catch was a Lincoln sparrow. I banded so many Lincoln sparrows there. We also caught song sparrows, yellow warblers, house wrens, and occasional flycatchers.
And so once you banded them, what was the reason for that?
So bird scientists, ornithologists, have to mark a bird in order to monitor the movements and locations of that same individual, and then that gives them information about the overall population, you know, for that species, where they're going and when. So there are other methods now that are used, but banding is still a very basic method for monitoring bird movements, and is still very much like a foundational tool that ornithologists are using. When they put a band on a bird, that band has a unique number on it, and all of the bands are recorded at the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service headquarters, I believe in Patuxent, Maryland, so that if at any point a band is recovered with or without the bird that it was attached to, the location where it was recovered and whether or not, you know, it was on a live bird or a bird that's been found deceased, that information goes back into the database and scientists can then know, oh, this bird was banded in Minnesota, but then it was re-caught in missed nets in another banding station in Arizona, for example. And that gives them a good glimpse of that bird's movements and timing throughout the year. So that's the main reason why bands are put on birds. And the recapture rate is really low. I think it's hovering around maybe 1%. So that's a pretty low rate. A lot of bands are put on birds, and then only 1% are then followed up on, because birds are hard to keep track of. It's hard to catch, you know, recatch the same individual again. But that said, in some cases, the same individuals are recaptured and with a tremendous regularity rate, like a song sparrow might be caught in New Mexico at a certain banding station, and then the very next year, that same bird might be recaught again at the same location on nearly the same day. So wow. those types of recaptures also help us know that birds can be pretty regular, like their migrations, their timings, their routes are very, very much the same year to year in a lot of species.
You studied with Paul Ehrlich. Who was he?
Yes, he was one of my professors. I actually took, in addition to helping with bird banding at the Rocky Mountain Biological Laboratory, I also took a graduate level course called Biology and the Human Predicament. And it was taught by 6 different professors, most of whom were from Stanford University, including Paul Ehrlich. And he is still a professor at Stanford, and he still goes back to the lab and works with his graduate students there. And he's a professor who's known for his specialties in coevolution, population biology, conservation biology, and then also ornithology. And one of his research projects at the lab was looking at a special woodpecker called the red-naped sapsucker. These birds also live over here in the Aspen area. They're pretty common throughout Colorado, actually. And he was focused on researching these woodpeckers to learn more about their roles in their ecosystems as keystone species, meaning that this bird's lifestyle and behavior is actually critical to a whole array of other species' well-being and survival, tied in very, very tightly, so that when you have red-naped sapsuckers around, then this whole array of other species is supported. And when red-naped sapsuckers are not there in an ecosystem, then that whole array of species is either less or not present.
Wow.
Yeah, so pretty fascinating and a true honor to get to learn from and do research with someone like Paul Ehrlich.
Does the Roaring Fork Valley have a good population of the red-naped sapsucker now?
Yes, these woodpeckers are here. In fact, we just saw one at Hallam Lake yesterday, and last week we saw an active nest of these woodpeckers on a birding outing that we did for ACES on Basalt Mountain through the edge of the Lake Christine Burn area. And they're beautiful. They're a medium-sized woodpecker with lots of red. I think of all of our local woodpeckers, the red-naped sapsucker has the most beautiful red coloration on its head and throat area. Mainly they're in aspen groves and around extensive willows and alders and sort of that leafy deciduous forest.
And you mentioned the Lake Christine wildfire and birding near there. Can you talk a little bit about what you're seeing now with the wildfires in this area and what they might be doing to the bird population?
So there's a lot of current research that's shedding new light on how wildfires change habitats and how wildlife take advantage of unique resources available to them in burned landscapes. And so while the Lake Christine fire was human-started and tragic on that level, and so many people had their lives turned upside down as they evacuated, the flip side is burned forests are actually really attractive to birds. Certainly there are some birds that need to leave and can't live in the post-fire forest or landscape, but there are many others that can still thrive there and still others that actually are attracted to that particular landscape. And they're found in healthy forests where they naturally live, as well as in the burn area, which is, you know, completely different elevational life zone and, you know, different types of trees. When we did our field trip up there last week, we saw, for example, olive-sided flycatchers in that area, and this is a bird that's typically found in higher elevation forests that are kind of ragged and weathered and torn up by wind events, blowdowns, avalanches, and then obviously they are also attracted to the post-fire landscape as another sort of impacted area. They love to have standing dead trees, lone snags they can perch in with great viewing and flying space around so they can catch the insects that they feed on. So that was fascinating.
You also worked and researched in Hawaii. I'm wondering if you can talk about where your research stands now and what bird you were researching there.
So I was a biotechnician on a research project for researchers with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service on the Big Island, and we were working out of a remote field station at 9,000 feet on the side of Mauna Kea, which is the main mountain on that island. Our species of focus was called the palila, which is a native forest bird of Hawaii. And the status of that bird now is there's about 1,000 in the wild, and they are impacted by non-native vegetation and by a whole array of non-native wildlife, including goats, sheep, rats, and mongooses that impact their nesting success. And like so many other Hawaiian birds on islands, once non-native species arrive, they can really wreak havoc on the native species that have developed very specific habitats that they need and requirements that are only found on those islands. And so for the palila that eat the pods of the mamame tree, life is kind of tough now with all the competing non-native things in their forest. But it was fascinating and a privilege to be there researching them in the 90s, and I'm so glad that at least there's 1,000 of them left, and there's a huge effort ongoing to preserve these birds and a lot of their other avian neighbors in Hawaii.
I'd like you to take me through an ideal day of bird watching in the Roaring Fork Valley. When is the best time? Is June the peak month of breeding activity, and are we just leaving that ideal time now?
Well, June is a fabulous month for birding, absolutely. Breeding is in full swing. The birds are singing. There's a wonderful very strong dawn chorus where the birds are belting out their songs early in the morning, and there's a lot of territories being set up, nests being built, and some of the earlier breeding birds are actually fledging their young by then. So June is wonderful, but actually birding all 12 months out of the year is fantastic, and each season offers its own exciting birding moments. So going forward now in July, it's baby season. There are so many fledglings out and about, and that adds a new challenge to birders. Identifying a fledgling junco, for example, is really hard because they don't look anything like their parents. And then as birds complete their nesting cycle, their hormones shift gears and they're less compelled to sing. So that dawn chorus tapers off a bit and birds start to disperse and some even start to migrate across the landscape. And in that case, they're not necessarily vocalizing or singing as much. And for the species that are tricky to identify by how they look, such as flycatchers, when they stop vocalizing and we don't have their unique voice or their unique song to help identify them, then that elevates the challenge to another level too. And, you know, further into the late summer, we start to see other bird species that don't nest here, that nest actually far to the north of us and are passing through our area on their southbound migrations, such as Townsend's warblers, Rufous hummingbirds, calliope hummingbirds, and then a whole bunch of different waterfowl. It's really fun to see those migratory species moving through. And then winter is wonderful, too. I can go on and on. Each season has unique highlights for birders.
And I love the term dawn chorus. So would you say the best time for birding is in the morning?
Well, that's the classic best time of day to get out. And the main reason is why the birds are becoming active early in the day. They start to sing when there's less other competing noises going on. It's nice and quiet, so they can kind of dominate the sound waves in the morning. And they're hungry, so there's a bout of activity as birds start feeding as the light comes into daytime. Then things sort of taper off toward midday when we have hot days. The birds actually become less active. Probably early afternoon is kind of the lowest ebb for songbird activity, but that's balanced out by an increase in activity of birds of prey. So afternoon when the thermals, the rising columns of warm air, are fully developed. The red-tailed hawks, the Swainson's hawks, peregrine falcons, a lot of those hunting birds are out and about hunting for the small mammals and birds that they eat. So, yes, morning is a wonderful time to start your birding day, but there really is no bad time. There's always some type of birding that's really fun and engaging all throughout the day, through late afternoon, evening, night. It's all good.
And if you could pick what birds would be in your dawn chorus, what would they be?
Oh, wow. I love the sound of the Cordieran flycatcher, which I hear outside my window every morning. The robin, actually, the American robin is just such a beautiful singer. So I would definitely choose that one to be in my dawn chorus, too. And I love to hear the warblers, the yellow-rumped, the Wilson's warbler. I love the Virginia's warbler. All of the warblers have just such beautiful songs, and they're so subtly different. It's really fun as a birder to try to key in on those and figure out who's who by how they sound. So I'd put those in my dawn chorus, too.
When I'm listening for birds, usually I'm hearing many, many birds at once and at different pitches. Do birds of different species communicate with each other, and are they competing with each other, or are they cooperating?
Wow, yeah, great question. There's all of the above is going on. And yes, birds can understand not only what is being said within their own species, but also what other birds, you know, very different species are saying. So birds have functional language. They have songs, which are used to proclaim territory and to attract mates. They also have calls, which would be like utility language. That would be maybe an adult bird saying something to fledglings or hatchlings in the nest, begging for food. Those are different types of calls. And then another type of call that a lot of different birds and even mammals will all understand and pay attention to, even across species, would be alarm calls. So birds can be the alarm callers of a neighborhood. They have their eyes so sharply on all the activity around them, and they have certain calls that may indicate a certain type of risk or threat, like maybe there's a house cat going by, or maybe there's a squirrel that's close to somebody's nest, or perhaps there's a Cooper's hawk that just flew over. The birds will give different alarm calls for those different types of threats, you know, something on the ground, something in the air, something in a tree, and the whole neighborhood really understands that, and they benefit from that communication.
Wow, that's incredible. And is this one way that, I guess I'm wondering how we as humans can tell that birds are intelligent?
Yes, absolutely. A lot of recent research has really revealed how intelligent birds are, and their truly remarkable adaptations to their aerial lifestyles and all the incredible stunts that they have to pull from migrating tens of thousands of miles to birds knowing instinctively where they need to go, even if they're not migrating with the adults of their population, their voices and their abilities to communicate pretty sophisticated messages does show their intelligence level and their ability to respond to their surroundings, make decisions, and even cooperate together. Birds can even anticipate things.
Your book offers some birding tips. What would you say are a few of the most important tips that would enhance a novice's experience?
I absolutely love birding in the field with new birders. It's so fun to see people catch fire with it and really take off. And once you get bitten by the bug, you just can't not look at birds anymore. So a few tips I would throw out. First of all, there's so many different ways to engage with birds and appreciating them and learning. And it's easy to get overwhelmed if you think, oh, I have to figure out these sparrows and they're all brown and streaky, or, oh, I really have to get out there at 6 a.m., but I'm not a morning person. There's so many ways to do it, and, you know, just follow your nose and go with what feels right to you. But a couple of field craft tips that I'll add in there are binoculars are really helpful. They're not totally necessary, but they are super helpful to have. And one thing that's kind of tough at the beginning is getting your binoculars right on a bird, because birds don't typically sit still very long, and you have to develop that skill in aiming your binoculars at the bird really quickly so that you can see them before they leave. And one thing that works well there is if you just see the bird with your eyes, lock your eyes on the bird, and then bring your binoculars up, and you should be right on the bird. And then beyond that, just learning the habitat of your area. And the book that Mark Fuller and I did, Birds of Aspen in the Roaring Fork Valley, has a wonderful habitat section in it that will familiarize people with the life zones and the specific habitats throughout the valley, so you get a sense of which birds you might see where. And then beyond that, just getting out with other people is super helpful. Spending time with friends, with other birders in the field, joining a field trip that is offered. The conversations, the knowledge of the guide, and everybody sharing their observations and their knowledge is just really rich experience and can help a new birder learn more quickly and experience less maybe frustration in the field if they're out there on their own trying to identify tricky birds.
Right now, you are a birding guide through ACES. How long have you been doing these guides, and can you tell us a little bit more about that?
I have been doing this for ACES for, I'm going to guess, maybe 12 years now, and we have expanded to offer birding on Tuesdays year-round. And we also have added in a lot of special field trips that go to certain locations like Basalt Mountain that I mentioned. We also bird at the top of the pass, and occasionally we get permission to go to various private properties where we get into other special habitats. And it's pretty rich, the array of experiences that are offered.
In the foreword of your book, it's mentioned that there are more than 500 different bird species that can be seen in Colorado. How many are there in the Roaring Fork Valley?
The local checklist for the Roaring Fork Valley has about 240 species on it, and that includes birds that migrate through and are fairly uncommon. So it's a pretty big list, and really reflects the diversity of habitats and landscape that we have here with the elevational relief of our valley starting at Independence Pass over 12,000 feet and going all the way down to Glenwood Springs and the valley of the Colorado River at 5,000, 6,000 feet elevation. We have quite a great diverse avifauna here. We chose 155 of those species to highlight in our book so that our book would be usable and appealing and not intimidating to a novice birder, and at the same time useful, interesting, and informative to experienced birders.
Just thinking about your book and then the article you wrote in the Sojourner, you discussed your big year and the approach you and Mark Fuller took a few years ago. You mentioned that you saw 138 of those 155 in your book, and I wonder if you thought that the more casual pace that you described made for a richer experience for you.
Oh, yeah, a great question. We, Mark and I, loved that big year that we did. And our goal with that was mainly just to record stories and experiences of two birders, ourselves, taking a year to just document all the birds that we saw and special moments that we had in the field from a level of effort that a regular person could relate to.
Hmm.
So the big year concept goes back to early in the 1900s, someone decided to challenge himself with trying to see as many birds in North America as possible in one year. And from that, many other people have attempted this challenge. And so that's the classic big year. And that involves jumping on planes at a moment's notice to go see some rarity in Alaska or in, you know, the East Coast, and driving miles and miles and miles and really kind of giving your life up to chasing birds for
Wow.
a full year, which is super fun and absolutely a great thing to do. But we wanted to do a different kind of big year, more of a local big year, as birders who also have, you know, busy lives going on so that people could relate. And we had so much fun documenting that and sharing it in that Sojourner article.
And how many birds are on your life list now?
Well, I can't actually answer that question. Everybody has a different approach to how they document their birding. Some people don't keep lists at all. Some people photograph everything they see and have massive photo archives. Others keep their lists. They have year lists. They have county lists. They have all sorts of ways of parsing out and documenting what they've seen. I actually use eBird. I submit eBird lists to record what I've seen and to report it to the Cornell Lab of Ornithology so that hopefully it's useful data that scientists can make use of. But I don't really look at my total numbers. I'm just not focused on that.
Would you care to name a few, I guess, rare species that you've seen around here?
Wow, let's see. More uncommon birds that I've seen around here. Wilson's phalarope is a wonderful bird that migrates through occasionally, and I've had really fun moments, even with ACE's outings, encountering these birds in the fall when they're on their southbound migration. So that was an exciting one. Another bird that was super fun to see was an American avocet, which is a long-legged wading bird that touched down in one of the ponds right up on the top of Independence Pass, a very unusual place to see an American avocet. So that was another exciting moment. And once in a while, a loon comes through the valley. There was a common loon on Hallam Lake a number of years ago, and that was very exciting. Lots of people came down to see it.
You mentioned, I think, in your book that half the birds in the book are migratory, and I'd like to understand that a bit more fully. Are the other half full-time residents?
Yeah, so that's basically how it breaks down, and we like to be able to put things in neat, tidy boxes, like migratory or resident, but really migration is kind of messy and all over the place. There are certain birds for whom the entire population moves from their summer breeding grounds to a completely place where they spend the winter. Hmm. And then there are other birds who are partial migrants, in which case some of the population may stay on the breeding grounds while the rest of the population leaves. And then there are residents who stay, basically, and don't migrate anywhere long distance, but they may move elevationally. So there's pine grosbeaks that nest in the subalpine forest up high. You have to take the gondola up or do a hike up high in order to see them in the summer, but then they show up at your feeder in town in the winter. And so that's an example of one that does an elevational migration. But overall, about half of the species in the book do leave this area, and they go various distances to spend the cold months, while the other half of the birds in the book are basically here in the valley year-round.
Okay. How has climate change affected migration patterns?
That is something that we'll probably be able to answer so much better in retrospect years from now, very completely, but there is a lot of understanding being developed now as well, and we are seeing some mismatches starting to occur when, say, the hummingbirds come through and the flowers have already bloomed that they're relying on for early season, or swallows coming back and the insects that they need aren't present or not in the numbers that they need to forage on and maintain their weight. So we're starting to see a little bit of mismatch in food resources, timing, and birds' arrival departure times, with the lengthening summer season and random wacky cold snaps and severe bouts of weather that affect the seed setting of wildflowers and affect the insect populations that migrating birds need. And aside from migration, we're also seeing expansions of ranges, such as the pygmy nuthatch and the black-tinned hummingbird. These two species have expanded up valley in the last 5 to 10 years, and where they used to be really uncommon or even unheard of in the upper valley, now they're here regularly. Wow. It's very interesting to see this, and I guess the upside of that story is it shows nature has a lot of resilience, and we just hope that that resilience can keep up with the pace of change.
You mentioned you use eBird, and so documentation like that for the everyday person or birders that are out there must be really important.
It is, yes. eBird is basically citizen science at its best, and the researchers at the Lab of Ornithology at Cornell University got the brilliant idea of creating this app that anybody can download onto their phone or onto their laptop at home and report their bird observations. There's millions of people in North America who consider themselves birders and get out on a regular basis looking at birds, and it's basically crowdsourcing their observations, where it would take grad students or volunteers many, many hours in the field to gather all of this data. It now flows in to eBird via this app from people like you and me just reporting what we see. And that is providing an incredible record of bird populations, trends, movements that scientists can use to draw conclusions, to then answer or ask further questions, and the information that they're synthesizing out of this data is valuable for decision makers and policy makers, helping us to do everything from locate wind turbines appropriately to, turning off lights in cities during peak migration times when we don't want the lights to mess up birds' migration. So it's pretty important and extremely helpful to birds.
Some of the birding apps out there are pretty incredible. It sounds like eBird. And I wondered, how do you think about the use of some of the other ones while birding?
Merlin is probably the one that I see people using the most on my outings. My favorite one is the Sibley app, and it basically is like putting that Sibley field guide into your phone along with the recordings of the birds so that you can listen to recorded calls or songs and compare that with what you're hearing in the field to help your learning of the bird vocalization.
What about using those bird calls to draw out birds in nature?
Yeah, so that is something that birders do, and even researchers will employ that at times to coax a bird out into view. That has to be used very judiciously, because when you're playing a bird vocalization and a real bird in the wild is then responding to that, it's taking their time and their energy away from the important activities that that bird has to do, such as watching for predators and feeding itself and gathering food for its nestlings. It's important to keep this in mind if you're birding somewhere where a lot of birders spend time. And in those instances, I typically recommend not using an app to play any bird calls, because we don't want to wear out those birds or impact them otherwise. Yeah, just a good dose of common sense can help people know when it's appropriate or not to use those. And I always like to say, go back to the car, play it in the car, or put your earbuds in or listen to it at home. That's always your first choice. And then using it in the field very, very judiciously.
When I joined your guided birding session at Rock Bottom Ranch, along with a painting class, you mentioned how drawing or painting birds can be beneficial to identifying birds. Can you explain what you meant?
When you sit down to draw a bird, you really have to know that bird's shape and proportions and color patterns. You even need to know, you know, how its posture is when it perches, and then like its habitat, so you can paint the surrounding vegetation around it. And I think that's the epitome of really deeply knowing a bird. I wish that I did more bird artwork myself. I'm sure my skills would be put to the test to try to remember every tiny, subtle little detail about a bird when I need to put it down on paper. But yes, artists really know the birds in the finest detail.
That's interesting. Rebecca, when can one that's living here in the Valley or visiting the Roaring Fork Valley come birding with you?
The birding program is ongoing, and the best way to learn about it is going to aspennature.org. That is ACE's website. We offer morning birding every Tuesday morning across the entire summer and into fall. So that's a great time to come and join me. And we roll out our other special field trips ongoingly across the summer and even in winter via email and ACE's website. So check those out and come join me.
What's next for you? What are you working on other than guiding bird outings for ACE's? What's next for you?
Oh, just more of my own personal birding. I love getting out anytime we travel to explore birds in other areas and keep learning. And I have a regular trickle of writing assignments that come through, so focused on writing about birds as much as I can and sharing that with the community.
Rebecca, thank you so much for joining me. It's been a real pleasure.
Thank you, Abby, so much. I'm happy for your interest. Thanks for the chance to talk with you today.